Welcome to the Freelancer Podcast. My name is Kyle Prinsloo, and in this podcast, I talk about freelancing nuggets without the fluff to help you become a better freelancer. Alrighty, guys, I'm here with Michael Jander, and honestly, I'm actually nervous. This is the first interview that I've done, and I've done many, and I'm actually quite nervous for this chat. And as a side note, I've literally prepared an intro in terms of who Michael Jander is. I've not done that before with any other guest, so that says something.
Honored.
So let me start with a short summary to introduce Michael Jander in my words, based on what I've researched about him. He's an award-winning designer, agency owner, and author. He's worked with massive clients like Google, Disney, Warner Brothers, Fox, and more. You also play piano, speak Spanish, bench press 300 pounds, and you have a black belt in karate. Is there anything?
The side hustles. Those are the side hustles.
So I think the big question that I have for you to start us off is there anything that you have not accomplished yet?
You know, I am an achiever. I'm an achiever kind of a person where I like see the top of the mountain and I want to go and climb the top of that mountain. But as I get older, I have to take things off of my list because my knees hurt more than they used to. My elbows, I'll get tendonitis in an elbow. So some of the physical things, I'm starting to feel the pain of aging. But I love... You know, I think life is short and you got to pick a few things that you want to accomplish in your life and then go after them. You don't want to wake up 20 years from now and say, oh, I always wish I would have gotten a black belt in karate. That was on my goal list when I was 16 and I never did it. Well, I earned mine when I was 37 and did it while I was growing my agency. And it was because it was something that I always wanted to check off the list of my life, and so I did it. You can get time, but you only get one shot at life, so you might as well pick some things and make them happen.
Wow, we're off to a great start, and I love that perspective. Yeah, thanks for sharing that. So you heard my intro, Michael. How would you describe yourself?
You know what, I kind of was an accidental freelancer and grew my agency. And now I'm living the dream, as one of my buddies told me the other day. I'm living the dream because the thing that I loved to do the most throughout my career, where I was creative director for 4 or 5 years before I started freelancing. And I found that I loved mentoring a junior level designer and helping them produce higher quality work. And helping people navigate different client challenges and things. I always loved that piece of design leadership throughout my career. And then I was able to do a ton of that while I owned my agency and had a bunch of employees. But now I get to do that at scale to a lot more people by sharing content on social media channels, doing one-on-one coaching or group coaching or podcasts like this, where we get to chat and try and dig up a handful of little things that might make a difference in somebody's life when they're trying to navigate the craziness of being a creative person for a living, because it can get crazy out there for us. So much of what we produce to clients is subjective based on do they like it or not like it, and it's opinion oriented, and then there's so much emotion tied into it because we put our creative energy, which is a piece of our soul, into the work that we're producing. And then we throw it over to a wolf to tear it apart. And it can be emotionally traumatic. And, you know, I just love being able to kind of help people navigate that with a little bit more ease than what I probably did when I was trying to grow my agency.
Yeah. And I know that it's been going well. I mean, you've helped so many people. And I'm curious, before I pick your brain on some other questions and get into the meat of this, but what are your goals, and what do you hope to accomplish this year and beyond?
This year, I'm trying to migrate my audience over to YouTube. My big audience is on Instagram, and that's where I focused my attention over the last couple of years, and built a great audience. And I love my audience and community and relationships that I've built over on Instagram. But the changes to Instagram are not aligned with what I love to do. The changes, meaning the push for reels and 10-second reels of people dancing around and pointing at things. And that's just not the kind of content that I like to produce. I do prefer a little bit longer form content. I prefer giving real value. And a lot of what Instagram is pushing right now is more TikTok related. There, you can have some educational stuff, but you got to figure out how to cram it into 15 seconds to make the algorithm like it. And 15 second pieces of value are just the crumbs of what I really want to share. So a YouTube platform is a better platform for me. Nothing against Instagram. I love what Instagram has provided me, but I'm not a big fan of the recent changes in the type of content that Instagram wants to push to its users. So answer number one, YouTube. I got to build my YouTube channel, which is what I've been working on. And I've been having a lot of fun experimenting with different pieces of content and sharing what I want to share and not caring so much about trying to figure out, oh, I got to jump on the next big viral, whatever. And I've got to try and, you know, sell out a little bit to try and grow. I'm not into that. I'm just going to share value over time and let it grow organically over time.
Yeah, that's a good point. Okay, so let's start some of the meatiness, some of good. The juicy questions. And I'm sure that you've received this question like hundreds or thousands of times. And a lot of the people watching this, listening in, they are struggling freelancers. They're not sure about how to create freelancing business, get their first client, should they do an agency or not? There's a lot of overwhelming questions, right? So the question is this, how to get started as a freelancer?
Good, that's a good question. I mean, that's a broad question. So how to get started as a
freelancer? I kept it broad intentionally.
It's pretty broad. How to get started as a freelancer? Okay, so there are a couple of things. You need money. You need money to be able to sustain your life before you bail on leaving a job that you have. So while you're working, what happened to me, and I'll just share from my experience, I was working at Fox before I started freelancing. And the final 6 months that I was at Fox, I was freelancing for some of my friends who had been laid off from our group and found new jobs, and they started hiring me to freelance, and I was making double my salary. So I had my salary coming in from Fox, and then I would work in the evening and on weekends doing my freelance work, and I was making as much freelancing as I was in my salary, but I didn't need the freelance money. So I just saved it up. And when it came time for me to finally jump ship and start freelancing full time, I had money in the bank. I had 6 months worth of cash flow coverage to cover my living expenses sitting there in the bank. And that's one of the things that, you know, it's one of the things that kills freelancers quick is if you don't have some cash reserves. And the number to look for is 3 to 6 months of cash reserves to cover your living expenses. That's the healthy number. So if you have to pay $5,000 a month to pay for your lodging, your home, your utilities, whatever your cost of living is, if it's $5,000 a month, then you're looking for somewhere between $15,000 and $30,000 in the bank to be able to freelance. Now that number can scare people, but it's not the only way that you can do it, because you could also land a retainer client that's going to pay you $2,500 a month and you sign them for a 6 month agreement. Well, there's half your money. You can use that to project forward and say, okay, I've got a retainer client that's paying me half of what I need. So now the number that I need is not 15 to 30,000, it's 7,500 to 15,000, and I just need to keep my retainer client happy. And that's what I see a lot of freelancers who take that next step. You either need the money in the bank or a client who's consistently giving you work with a commitment to future work that can give you the confidence to take that step as well. So that's, I think that's one of the big things. And that's one of the things that kills a lot of freelancers. If you don't have cash in the bank to cover when the client pays you 1 week late on your project, and now you can't pay your electric bill as a result of it, that's no way to live.
Yeah, I think that's an often overlooked piece of advice that you have there, because it's extremely practical, and a lot of people want to rush to, you know, quit their jobs and to live a life of freedom on the beach, you know, with their laptop with like a drink in their hand or something, and they forget the practical side. You know, I mean, at the end of the day, you know, clients pay the bills, you know?
Yeah.
And yeah, so I love that piece of advice. Thanks for sharing that.
I love what you just said about freedom too. And I have a chapter in my book, Burn Your Portfolio, that's called it's flexibility, not freedom. The life of being a creative entrepreneur, a freelancer, it's not freedom. It's flexibility. That's what you get. And you're still going to work 30, 40, 50, 60 hours a week, but the flexibility means that you can choose where you want to spend those hours or what exact hours you want to spend. It doesn't make the hours go away. And a lot of freelancers think, oh, I'm just going to go, I'm going to have the freedom of being a freelancer. It's not freedom. You still are tied to deadlines and clients. And now, instead of having one boss at the company you work for, now you have five clients and five bosses all giving you instructions of what they want you to do. That's not freedom. It's just a change in who's your boss. And now you have five instead of one. And you now can go and choose if you want to sit in Starbucks and work for 5 hours, or sit at your computer, or work at the airport, or stay up tonight and work instead of during the day. You can choose. That's flexibility in choice, but it's not really freedom. And I learned that kind of early on. And there's a point where you can get some freedom, but it isn't in the early years of freelancing. You've been freelancing, Kyle. So do you feel flexibility or freedom or neither?
Yeah. So first of all, I agree. I agree with that. And I love that use of word. So I'm going to be changing my word from freedom to flexibility. I think it's a lot more accurate. And yes, I do agree. Later in life, as your business grows and all that, it could perhaps lead to freedom, but definitely in the beginning stages, it's more that flexibility side. And to answer your question now, because I'm juggling so many different things at the moment, because I did have a lot of freedom, now I've got a lot more flexibility.
Yeah, a lot of flexibility. It's good.
Yeah.
I did get to a point of some freedom. So, but it didn't happen until I had probably 15 employees where I could take those longer vacations, you know, but it never really went away. I still would check my email every morning, and I would check my email midday when we break for lunch. And then I would reply to any of the drama of the day in the evening. But I had 15 employees that were pushing the pixels around and navigating the day-to-day of the clients. But my responsibilities didn't go away to the company and to the leadership of the company. I still had that. And when the crap was hitting the fan on something, I'm the one taking the client phone call, walking around on the beach while my family plays in the sand, and I'm on the client phone call trying to dig out of whatever hole we were in at the time.
Circling back to the how to get started part, because I love that perspective, to make it more practical, you know, to have some savings and all that. Now let's assume I've got that right. So yeah, I'm ready. I've sort of figuring things out. I've got some cash on the side. Now there's obviously a lot we can expand on, but I want to just touch on a few things here. And a big topic is pricing. So how does one price their services effectively? And this follow-up question is, what type of services should they actually offer?
Okay, well, those are two, both of those are big questions. So my pricing methodology is based on understanding three different variables that all affect how you price your work. And the first variable is, how much money is it going to cost you to produce the thing for the client? So we'll take a logo as an example. I want to give you the 3-minute version of my pricing methodology. You have a logo, client asks you to design a logo. You sit back and say, okay, it's going to take me, I'm going to spend 40 hours on this logo. And my hourly rate is $50 an hour. So my logo should be $2,000. That's my number in my head. Now, that's only one of the variables. I'm not a fan of billing by the hour or even calculating your price by the hour, but you have to know that number first, because you don't want to bid lower than that number. Otherwise, you're cutting into your profit or even your ability for the project at all to be profitable. It could be unprofitable if you're below that number. So variable number one, you got to understand your production costs. Variable number two is market value. What are all the other freelance designers out there that are like you charging for logos? And in your situation, Kyle, you're in South Africa. So you look at and you say, okay, other designers that maybe they're not all in South Africa, but that's what I need to understand. How much are designers in South Africa charging to clients in the United States for logo design? And you do some research and you can find this information, maybe not specific to country, but you can find information on logo price ranges. And you'll see things from, you know, 20% of people are charging less than 500, and 40% of people are charging somewhere between 800 and 1200. And then 25% are charging in the 1500 to 2500 range. And then you have 5% charging 10,000 or more. So you'll find these surveys on the internet. Just do a search for how much do people charge for logos, and you find all kinds of articles and surveys. So that's market value. We got to understand what other people are charging, because it affects our ability to charge our client. If you're way too high on the end of the spectrum, the client is looking at it and they'll say, it's called cost of the best alternative. They'll say, I'm not going to hire Kyle for a $7,000 logo when the cost of the best alternative, another designer who does good enough work like Kyle, is going to charge me $2,000. All of a sudden, you can't justify the higher price because you're too far on the high end of market value in the perception of the client. So we have to understand what other people like us are charging for the same type of work. The third variable, and let's just say for the sake of this, that you do a little research and you find that logo prices are $2,500. So you know that your production cost is $2,000. Your market value is around 2,500. Your buddy told you that he's charging 2,500 for logos. You went to university with him. And so you kind of got a sense that that's a good number for me. And then the final budget number, the final variable number, is client budget. How much does the client have or want to spend to design this logo and solve whatever business problem they're trying to solve? And you have that conversation with the client. You ask them. In this discovery phase of conversation, you say, okay, this is great. Love all the information you've given me. One final question. What do you have a budget you're trying to work with to do this logo design? That's one way you can do it. Or you can throw them a range. You can say, okay, this is great. We usually logos on the high end will be around $3,500. On the low end will be around $2,500. Is that a price range that you're comfortable in? And you can get a response from them. So you can either ask or you can give them a price range. But either way, you're going to get a sense of their budget if they're comfortable with that range. Now we have three variables. We have production cost $2,000. We have market value $2,500. And we have client budget at $3,500 they said they were comfortable with. Where do we want to price our project? Well, it's somewhere in the range of those numbers. And the number that we choose is usually based on the situation that our business is in. If you haven't had a project in 7 months and you're using your last bit of money that you have in the bank to pay for your electric bill today, then where are you going to price it on that spectrum? Are you going to be $3,500 or are you going to price it more toward your production cost of $2,000 to increase the possibility of winning it? Most designers would say, well, I really need this, so I'm gonna price it on the lower side of this. I gotta land this thing. But let's say that you're working 80-hour weeks right now and you've been slammed and you're stressed out of your brain, but you know what? You'll take on a new client if the price is right. Are you gonna bid it around $2,000, your production cost? No, you're gonna say, you know what? If they'll pay me a premium, $3,500 or $5,000, that I'll bid it for, if they'll pay me a premium, I'll do the logo for them and I'll work 90-hour weeks instead of 80-hour weeks because the money's too good to say no. So we have, once we understand those variables and then look at the situation that our business is in, it dictates where we're going to price this project. But we know it's going to be profitable because we started with production costs, and we know that we can win it because we understand the client's budget, and we know that we're not doing a discredit to the market by dramatically undercharging what other designers are charging or dramatically overcharging what other designers are charging. We understand market value. And so it allows us to price our work effectively for our clients. And this is the methodology I used at my agency over the 15-year run. We did $30 million in agency revenue, and it was all pricing with that kind of mindset. Okay, so that was a big answer for pricing. Where do you start?
I mean that was beautiful. If I could sum it up in one word, that was really, really fantastic perspective. So yeah, thanks for sharing that nugget, and I love how you simplified it and explained it in detail at the same time. Really, a lot to think about on that. And I also like the perspective of charging based on, you know, how your business is currently performing. I've not heard that perspective before, and I think that's really insightful.
It's the reality. We always have different circumstances. Take one, like this client, they're kind of, you don't really like them. You're sitting in discovery meetings and they're kind of a jerk. They're a little bit blunt. Mm. You're a little nervous that they're going to be difficult to work with. Are you going to price it on the high end of the spectrum or the low end of the spectrum? Well, in that situation, you're going to say, well, I'll work with them, but they better pay me a premium for the pain in the butt tax that I'm going to have to charge for that client. Or if they come to you, I have a bunch of different scenarios in my content on where we price these things. But if they come to you and they say, hey, Kyle, yeah, we're getting bids from five other designers on this. We're getting bids from five other designers, and we just need a bid from you. And you haven't had work in 3 months, and you know you're competing against five other designers. Are you going to price it on the high end or on the lower end? The circumstances dictate where you should choose your price for that project, because you want to win it, you need the work, and you're in heavy competition with other people to try and win that project. So we really have to understand and analyze, what situation am I in right now in my business? Because the last thing you want to do is say, oh, I heard that I should be charging $8,000 for logos because that's what they're worth to companies. And then all of a sudden you start trying to charge that and you lose every project and you have no cash flow as a result of it, because you bumped your price from $500 logos to $8,000 logos. And now you just destroyed your entire business as a result of it, because your business wasn't positioned right to generate that level of pricing.
Yeah. Lovely. Circling back again, we've gone from the first stage of like practical side, having some finances. We've learned, you know, some pricing nuggets, amazing so far. Now, at the end of the day, we need clients, right? Without clients, we have a hobby. We don't have a freelancing business.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how can we turn our hobby into a freelancing business? And caveat to that, there are dozens of ways to get clients. So I would like to know from you your top three ways to get clients.
Oh, I love it. Okay. Top three ways to get clients. The first thing, before we even talk about finding clients, you have to understand what your business is even offering. You have to have some kind of problem solution statement that you can make to a potential client. So you have to identify this. And it's a hybrid of a marketing message, an elevator pitch, and some niching and all of these things. So Kyle, what are some of the services that you offer as a designer to clients? Go ahead.
For me, it's basically web design and marketing.
Okay, web design and marketing. What kind of marketing? Like digital marketing for website related things?
So it's internet marketing, everything to do with online marketing. Yeah.
Great. Okay. So, and do you have a target niche that you target? Like your businesses come out of a certain sector?
Yeah, so I've got three, one in the medical industry, one in the therapy industry, and then one for general, you know, like all sorts of different businesses. Yeah.
Okay, good. So let's just take the medical industry niche. And this is what you have to define. What are the problems that they have? Well, medical industry, highly competitive for businesses. They usually have a lot of funding from governments and things. So they compete against each other with higher budgets that they have to spend. What's the problem that they have? Well, they have to get awareness of their product in comparison to their competitors' products. So they need awareness of their product so that they can generate online sales or brand expansion or whatever. So you create a marketing statement that says something like, hey, I'm Kyle. I create websites and digital marketing for medical industries or health and medical industries. And then you say the problem solution. So, and the services that we offer, what we focus on is converting website visitors into generated leads that the salespeople can follow up on. So now you've taken, here's my target industry. Here's my problem that I'm solving, lead generation, and then you give a statistic of some kind. Hey, for example, our last client that we did work for, we redesigned their website and it created a 73% increase in lead conversion from what they had before. Their people who came to their website after, we got 73% more leads as a result of our redesign. And that's what we do for our clients. Okay, now that kind of an elevator pitch is a sales pitch that you can make to every single other medical company that exists anywhere. They're going to be intrigued. You're going to look like an expert in their industry, and you're going to validate it with a statistical testimonial. And it'll make people say, oh, that's interesting. Who wouldn't want 73% increase on lead conversion because of a redesigned website? You've made it into something numeric. Okay, so way number one to get clients is now to tell that message to every person that you know from university and your mom and your aunt and your friends and people in networking events. You start sharing that message to everybody that you know, and you wait to find either a referral from somebody who says, oh, you know what? I know my friend has a medical startup and they just got their funding. Let me put you in touch with them. You'll hear some things like that. Or you'll be pumping that message into your social media and somebody will chime in the comments and say, hey, this is a really good fit for us. We'd love to learn more from you because you're sharing a case study in your social media that relates to them. And it's content that makes them see a solution to their problem that they're feeling. So version number one of finding clients is figure out your marketing message, that position that you have and the solution that you offer, and then go and pump that message out into every channel that you can. Okay. Do you have any questions or comments about that one? Because you asked me for three. I'll give you two more.
Yeah. So first of all, again, amazing. So a follow-up question that I receive a lot is, I've got my pitch. You know, I've got work for clients. You know, I can say, listen, you know, I've helped this client generate X, Y, and Z.
Yeah.
The question comes in, I'm new to freelancing. I don't have any previous client experience that I can use as, let's say, my case study and speaking from results and all of that. What can I say then?
Find statistics from other people. And you can find them. Like, you can go and find redesign statistics. Like, let's just say that it's give me a medical, like one of your clients. So who do you have, a big client that you've done some medical stuff for?
Yeah, so it's pretty interesting because literally today I had to record a presentation for a lead. And basically what I had was, all I did was I showcased exactly what we've done for other clients. So I showed him, you know, here's the Google Maps, number one. Here's the Google search results, number one. And I use the different cities, you know, for my different clients, all number one. And I don't say, okay, this is great. I say this resulted in over 50 bookings on the website alone, not even the calls, which in equivalence in this case, they are local clients. So they are the rand value. So let's say the dollar value is X. And I want to showcase that before I showcase my pricing.
Okay, so that's good. Yeah, show the results and attach dollars to it
in
the financial results. And then you converted the conversation to go from the client looking at it as an expense to the client looking at it as an investment that yields a return. So anytime you get it down to numbers is ideal. Let's just say that you have a client like, or you do some research. You asked, okay, you're a new freelancer and you don't have any of your own statistics. Then find statistics from other case studies around the web that you didn't do. Like, let's say that Pfizer, one of the big pharma companies in the world, let's say that Pfizer redesigned their website and somebody did an article about it showing that their redesigned website used to generate this much traffic, and after the redesign, it generated this much traffic, and the user session length went from 47 seconds to 1 minute and 38 seconds as a result of the redesign. You didn't do the work, but it still shows the power of what a redesign can deliver. And you can find case studies and articles about this kind of stuff all over the internet. Just start digging. People write this. I write this kind of stuff. I look for data like this and I intermingle it into my video content and things because I want it to have some substance behind it instead of just opinion. So you'll find articles like that and then use that in your marketing. Say, hey, we help medical businesses. We redesign medical business websites and we focus on converting leads lead conversion to capturing these leads. Now, one example, we didn't do this example, but Pfizer just redesigned their website and their lead conversion. I read an article that their lead conversion went up 32% as a result of the redesigned website that they launched. And the big change was that they focused on the mobile responsive version of the site as designed first and the desktop version second. So they focused on the usability in the mobile site. And that's one thing that our business does. Our business focuses on mobile first, and we can help you get results like what Pfizer got from their website. That conversation as a sales pitch, it wasn't my statistics, but it was statistics, and it still validates what I'm saying to the client, even though I admitted it wasn't my case study. It was just industry statistics that we found. It still gives it more punch. And your client can start to see numbers and say, oh, I do. I want 32% increase. I want that. So I think that that's the way you do it when you're just starting out and you don't have your own case studies. You still should know industry data. One that is a big one, and this is one that I started using even years ago, like when I left my agency in 2018 after my buyout ended. But even back then, it was like 80% of the internet was video content.
Yeah.
And it's probably even more now, but 80% of the downloaded data was video on the internet. Well, that statistic, I could use that to help convince any client we had into doing video content. Hey, you're missing the boat here. 80% of the entire internet is video and you're not doing any video. Why don't we create a video reel for your business? And clients, it's just an industry statistic, but clients will feel the fear of missing out, the FOMO, and be like, whoa, I'm missing the curve on this. We do need to do video. And all of a sudden it becomes a priority for them because I planted that seed in them using some statistical data from the industry. So you got to research the industry that you're looking at serving, and you got to understand what are these data points and what are the competitors doing and how do you use those changes in the industry that you're trying to serve to help your clients see a problem that they may not see right now. Was it bad for me to try and convince a client to do video? No, it was beneficial to their business. It was a service to their business. Does it generate work for me? Yes. And that's great for my business, but it's also great for their business because we're protecting them from missing out on the wave that they probably already missed out on as a result of being late. So anyway, this is the conversation type that you can have with clients.
Yeah. And I think, just to wrap up that point, I think that's an amazing, interesting take because in a way it's also pretty broad because you could say, if you type in, let's say, dentist in Manhattan, right? And they don't show up in the top three, you can still reference Google, let's say, to show like how many clicks or, some data that they should be getting. And then I find the best reference to make is not for them, it's their competitors to show them how much clicks they are getting and then they're missing out on that. So the FOMO.
Totally. It's so, man, entrepreneurs. Okay. So entrepreneurs are motivated by two big things. And there are more than this, but some are motivated by fear of loss. Like that's all humans are. But man, entrepreneurs are motivated by competition. And if you show them that one of their competitors is doing something more effectively than them, that creates pain in an entrepreneur. And because I'm that way, I'm entrepreneurial. And if I see that one of my competitors is doing something that I'm not, I'm like, oh, we gotta level this thing up. And you can use that in any conversation with clients to help them see that somebody is achieving more than them. And it leads to opportunity because you're kind of creating pain in the client. You're creating pain and they'll buy to alleviate that pain. So you say, you go to a competitor and you say in your business, you say, hey, I just noticed that your biggest competitor, here's their new website. They just launched it. I thought you should know. You're probably already aware of it, but they just launched it. Here it is. Looks great. They did a great job. Now you give that to your client and tell them that their competitor just did a redesign. What's going to happen? Sometime in the next 3 to 6 months, your client's going to want to do a redesign as well.
Yeah. 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 I love that. Okay. So you mentioned those two ways, talking about number two, second way, favorite way to get clients?
Building relationships just because. I built my entire business on just being friends with my clients. And half the time I didn't even have to ask for work. Half the time they would just give us work because they liked working with us. They trusted me. I had a friendship with them. And they were like, well, let's give this to Mike. People are good. Like generally speaking, people are good. Now I know there are a lot of bad people in the world. I get that, but I've traveled around enough to know that most people are good. They're good natured, good-hearted people. And if you're good friends with your clients, are they ever going to go to somebody else? No, they don't look around. They're not like, well, Mike's one of my close friends. I'm going to go try somebody else on this project. That's not what they do. They're like, Mike's one of my close friends. He'll get this done for us and it'll be good. He'll do a good job. I love Mike. I can't wait to work with him again. That is the way to get clients. How many of your clients, Kyle, have become your friends over time? You've been doing this long enough.
Yeah, I mean, I would say good friends, like people that I talk to, almost half of my clients. I would say,
so 50%.
Yeah, 30 to 50%.
Of those clients, are you worried that if another freelancer comes in and has a cool pitch deck and says, "Hey, we can do this stuff for you, and here's our cool pitch deck with design comps," do you think your clients will leave you to go and try out somebody new just for fun?
Yeah, and the answer is no. And I've had that before. People have pitched them a much lower service than I'm providing, but because I'm still getting results for them, and because I've got a relationship with them. I mean, as you say, the relationship is underrated.
Yeah. It is. And so that, then that's the reality. I saw it with my entire business, even to when we were doing, so after I sold my agency, the combined agency between my agency and the agency I sold to, we were doing like $7-8 million a year in revenue. Wow. And the majority of it was still relationship driven. It was still relationships. It wasn't the big money from those things were relationship driven sales. They weren't like some random person dropping out of the sky. Most of it came from repeating clients and referrals from repeating clients who were our friends. And that you'll find across the board, everywhere in the world, people love to do business with people they know, like, and trust. That's the cliche. And so get to know more people and be likable and be trustworthy, and you will get clients. And I think that for me is just the number one way to get clients. Just meet people, enjoy. Who knows, Kyle, this is our first conversation. Who knows what comes out of this? You know, you're building your YouTube channel. I'm building my YouTube channel. We're developing content. You have a podcast. I like to be on podcast. We have so many overlaps in what we're doing. Who knows what comes of this in the future? 2 years from now, we're doing some collab content for the same client or something. Who knows what comes of it? Or a client asks me for content. Hey, do you know anybody else who would be good to do some video, sponsor video content for us? Or do you know anybody in the freelance space that we could sponsor a podcast? And then I say, oh yeah, my friend Kyle, he does that. He has a podcast and does sponsored content. You just never know what's going to come of it. But is that why we're on the conversation right now, so that we can use each other for future opportunities? No, we're just here talking as new friends, having a conversation about the industry, and then we'll retain this friendship and build on it over years to come. And then doors will open as a result of it. And I saw this in my business going from one client to three. So the first year I probably had three clients, and then the next year of freelancing, I probably had five clients. And then the next year I had like 10 clients, and then 10 became 20, and then 20 became 40. And it just starts compounding, all completely based on me knowing more people. I would get to know all of the people at my client's business. So we would work with a project manager. I would fly to visit them, and I would meet all of the other people that they work with on their team. A lot of times we'd go to lunch, and we'd have 10 people at lunch, and I'd get to know all the other people. And then one of those people leaves and starts working at Warner Brothers. And now I get a client at Warner Brothers. And then a person leaves and goes and starts working at TDK or at TV Guide. And we got clients through those kinds of relationships, and it just compounds over time. So that is a long-winded way of me saying, meet people, be nice, be likable, and build relationships just for the sake of the fact that your life is richer with more relationships in it. And some of them will become clients as a byproduct.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, I almost want to leave it there in terms of your tips, because I think that that point is actually underrated. And I love how you explained it. But I am curious, if you have a third way, top way to get clients, please do share it. Otherwise,
okay,
we can leave
so
it on that.
The third way, ask for referrals. Ask for referrals. We, and as creatives, in these first two ways was a lot of passive style sales. But don't be afraid to do active sales. And let's just not say ask for referrals. Let's say ask for opportunities. So don't be afraid to reach out to your client that you haven't communicated with for a few months and send them a message that says, hey, just doing some planning for the next quarter of my production load. I loved working with you on this project 3 months ago. Do you have anything else coming up that I could keep on my radar? We'd love to work together again. So you're asking for an opportunity, then that's a way that you can do it. Or ask for a referral. At the end of a project, you had a successful project with a client and you say, hey, we loved working with you on this project. We loved how it turned out too. And we're so grateful that you got the results that we had talked about at the start, 32% increase in conversion. That was great. Do you know anybody else that might need the types of services that we offer? And you intentionally ask for the referral. So that's way number three. And it's more aggressive than the first two that are more passive. But man, don't be afraid to do that. There is power in the ask. And if you read any sales book is going to tell you that there's a certain moment when you have to go in for the ask. You have to try and convert the lead into a yes answer. So don't be afraid to start doing that in your business. I promise you'll get more work if you proactively ask for it than if you sit behind your computer and hope that something falls out of the sky.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, Michael, I mean, we can literally chat for another hour very easily. And I do want to respect your time. So I basically got, I think, two main questions to ask you, if that's okay with you.
Yeah,
or I can,
great.
Okay.
Yep. Yeah.
Okay, so you talk a lot online about residual income for web designers. And I think it's, personally, I think it's crucial. It avoids that valley income. You know, it's very easy to make a 10K once off month. But what about the next month? And I'm curious to know how you would describe residual income for web designers and how can freelancers do it?
Okay, so residual income for web designers, there are a few different services that you can offer your web design clients. Service number one is just website maintenance. Charge your client $500 a month and you commit, it's like an insurance plan for the work that you did. If there's a bug, you'll fix it. If the server goes down, the client calls you, they don't have to call GoDaddy and figure it out. The there's a plugin that needs to be updated on WordPress or something, you'll update it. You will keep their site running and you run checks on it. You do a QA every other week or something and run a QA check. You run a link break check. You actually provide active services to keep their website optimized. And you check it. A lot of clients are updating their own site from a content management system. You check and make sure that they didn't upload a 4 megabyte image when it should have been a 200 kilobyte image. You know, you check for these kinds of things. So website maintenance is an easy service to add on to the back end of a website project. Another one is SEO. SEO, yeah, you built the site. Now let's do the digital marketing stuff, Kyle, that you had mentioned. It's SEO, let's get traffic to it and let's get you number one placement in these keywords and let's do that piece of it. So search engine optimization is a service you can offer. Content marketing is a great service that you can offer. So you tell the client, hey, let's create 4 blog posts for you every month and we'll post them to your site. So we're going to hire a writer, we're going to write the blog posts and we'll post them to your website every single month. And that will help stimulate search engine interest in your business and it will position you as a thought leader. So we'll take that off your plate. Here's a price for content marketing that we can offer. And then the final one is conversion optimization. Conversion optimization, sell your clients on this. Every single month, you're going to run A/B tests on 3 different pages, their most high traffic pages. And you'll run an A/B test on trying a different product in the main promo, trying two different images, trying two different headlines, and you run A/B tests for them and you generate the winner, and then you've improved conversion minimal by minimal. Like, oh, we had a 1% increase in conversion on this one, and then we had a 3% increase in conversion on this one because we changed out the image. And you do that every single month, and you're tweaking the dials of the success of the website. When you try and sell that to a client, you can put them on a 3-month, 6-month engagement to do conversion optimization on their site every single month, figuring out how do we improve this to make people click. I wonder, and I don't know the answer to this, but I wonder how many people Amazon employs that are just doing conversion optimization on their website every day. Their whole job is to move the button one pixel over to the left, one pixel up, and test if there's any difference on conversion as a result of these micro improvements that they make. Certainly, they've got to employ tons of people that are completely focused on that. And all the big ones, Alibaba and stuff, these biggest e-commerce platforms in the world certainly are doing that, because the amount of money in the micro improvements is gigantic to the big companies. And it's usually can cover the cost of your service and add profit to the client, even for the small companies.
Yeah, I love that. Thank you for for sharing that, Michael. And I mean, you brought up Amazon. Just an interesting caveat. This story, when I read it years ago, it actually got me inspired to create websites, because I love the psychology of changing these things. I'm sure you've heard of the Amazon $1 million button or $400 million button. That story.
I don't know the story. Tell me the story. How do I not know this story?
Yeah. Wow. I think it was $400 million. If you type it in, $300 or $400 million, and basically that was additional revenue that Amazon generated in a specific period, let's say over a period of a year. And all they did was change one word in a button. Instead of the word register, they changed it to continue. The whole onboarding process was exactly the same. They just changed the word register to continue. And after I read this article, I was blown away that you could make these small changes and it could make big differences. And I did exactly the same when I worked in various different jobs and so on and so on. But that's a great point. And I love that point that you mentioned.
Okay, so I looked it up. It's the $300 million button. And I love this. And I'll bookend the start of our conversation about using industry data to sell your clients. You don't have to be the one who changed the button, but you can tell that exact story when you're selling conversion optimization to a client. So you finish your website and you sit with the client and you say, okay, we got the website live. It's all great. One of the things that we love to do at our business is to optimize your website for conversion over time. And what that means is that we're going to run tests and tweak things and see which version of the homepage promo performs better, and then we'll keep the best one live. So we run these A/B tests. And let me give you an example. Amazon did this in conversion optimization in one of their things, and it resulted in $300 million of increased revenue. And all they did was tested changing the button from register to continue, and it resulted in $300 million of revenue. That's what conversion optimization is. We're going to test things like that on your site. And no, it's not going to generate $300 million for you, but even if it generates an extra $300 for you, it'll be worth the effort to do it. Would you like us to put together a proposal for conversion optimization for you? And we'll talk specifics. So that's your sales pitch right there, using industry data. It's not my data, but industry data to go and talk to a client about your services for conversion optimization. And who's not going to be interested in your website clients are going to say, oh, that's interesting. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I'd love to see a proposal on that, because they're interested in micro improvements. Anyway, so that bookends it back to what we started with. in our positioning and using industry data.
First of all, it sounds like you've done this before.
I've done it for a couple of years. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Ending off, and it's a simple question, but I would like to know from you, if you could define one tip, just one tip, what would you say for aspiring or current freelancers?
It's scary. It can be scary. I was a scared freelancer at the start. Like I was still looking for jobs. I was billing probably 15 grand a month at the start of my freelancing. And I was still looking for, I was still applying for jobs because I was still afraid to be on my own. And I didn't need 15 grand a month to cover my life. I needed 5 grand a month. So I was dramatically over earning what I needed, but I was still scared because it's scary. It's the unknown. And so my tip is don't be afraid of it. You get one career. So go for it. If your dream is the flexibility of being a freelancer and sitting on the beach, then go for it. Go for it. Make it happen because you only get one career. What's the worst case scenario? It doesn't work out. And now you got to go get a job again. Well, if you were employable before you started freelancing, you'll certainly be employable after you freelanced. You're even more marketable having done some of your own entrepreneurship. You're more capable. So you get one career, and if you want to do it, go for it. You don't want to wake up 20 years from now and say, I always wish I would have tried freelancing. I really think I would have liked that, but I was too afraid to leave my job. You don't want that. Go for it. And when I'm saying go for it, I can promise you there are a lot more crappier designers and people than you that are somehow succeeding as a freelancer out there. And you have more talent than they do and more ability to succeed as a freelancer. So from the competitive standpoint, like we talked about a little bit in this too, which fuels me, I'm like, yeah, if so-and-so can do it, I can do it. Yeah, you should be looking at the world that way. And I promise you, there are some freelancers who are less talented that are somehow making a go of it. You certainly can too.
Amazing. Michael, fantastic. You've got books and courses. Where can people buy it?
You can go to michaeljanda.com, and I've got links to all of my stuff there. And you can find me more Janda on social platforms, YouTube, Instagram, everything but TikTok. Somebody took more Janda on TikTok and they have one post on there. So on TikTok, I'm even more Janda, but everywhere else I'm more Janda. So feel free to follow me. I give a lot of free content away too, so it's not all just paid stuff. I got a lot of free content that'll be helpful to your business.
Amazing. Michael, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for these nuggets. Really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks, Kyle. Super fun.
Awesome.